welcome to Eye on the Middle East, a weekly podcast produced by NeonTommy.com at USC Annenberg Digital News. Today is November 16th, 2011, and I am your host, Benjamin Gottlieb.
And I am your co-host, Arzu Rezvani. On today's program, Syria's Free Army and how U.S. and European companies are contributing to Syria's bloodshed. Joining us for our main discussion on escalating tensions between Israel and Iran is Consul General of Israel, David Siegel.
The Eye on the Middle East podcast can now be found on iTunes. Just search for Neon Tommy, Eye on the Middle East.
We start our program today with Syria. Syrian President Bashar al-Assad is facing a growing challenge to his iron rule from home and abroad on Wednesday.
Yes, renegade troops launched their most daring attack yet on the military, and world leaders are looking at possibilities for a regime without the entrenched Syrian dictator. The group, which operates primarily out of Lebanon, is calling itself the Free Syrian Army. It marks a clear change in tactics from the peaceful protests of the last few months. The army is made up mostly of defected Syrian soldiers and refugees.
Syria remains formally suspended from the 22-nation Arab League due to the government crackdown. UN estimates say that 3,500 people have been killed so far, but it seems that the Arab League needs outside forces, such as the Turks, to apply pressure on the Syrians. A representative from Turkey will appear at an upcoming meeting of the Arab League in Morocco to discuss future action.
Dozens of people are reported to have died in continuing unrest across Syria, as the king of neighboring Jordan has urged President Assad to stand down. In one incident, more than 30 troops were killed in clashes with suspected army defectors in a southern town near the Jordanian border. Meanwhile, U.S. company Blue Coat has finally acknowledged that the Syrian regime has been using its products, although without its direct consent. It is not the only Western company providing these services. Italian firm Area SPA, a surveillance company based outside Milan, is installing a system that will allow the Syrian government to dip into virtually any corner of the internet in the country. This certainly isn't the first time we've seen corporations doing bad business with repressive regimes. Is that right?
Yes, that's right. And I think as corporations continue growing, you'll see more and more incidents of companies playing a hand in political development, crackdowns, and violence. During the 1933 census, help in tabulation technology designed and provided by IBM through its German subsidiary proved to be pivotal to the Nazis in their efforts to identify, isolate, and ultimately destroy the country's Jewish minority. It was a story of conscious involvement, and that has unfortunately just emerged time and time again throughout history. In 2009, for example, you had Siemens Technology selling their products to the Iranian government, and those technologies were used to help monitor the citizenry.
Yes, but what about the argument that these are dual-use technologies, that these companies sell them with the hopes that they'll be used for benign purposes, but that they can't be held responsible if they're used for example, the monitoring of a citizenry?
The Germans have definitely made this argument, but every time I wonder what they would say about, for example, the sale of 200 tanks to the Saudis in July. Clearly, a tank is not a dual-use technology or product. So letting corporations escape with this dual-use argument has, I think, set the stage for far more egregious sales. So I think it's really important for people to be aware of the extent to which corporations are selling things to rogue regimes, to suppressive regimes. It's that element of transparency that needs to be in place.
We're bringing up a point about government selling military technology to rogue regimes, but there's also the issue of companies that are acting as paramilitary groups in countries, which is even outside of this, has even less accountability. I mean, Blackwater is something that first comes to my mind as a company that can operate inside of a war zone basically without any repercussions.
It's very, very important that as corporations continue to become more and more influential, that we demand to know more. We demand to know what their business is, where their business is taking place.
Sure, and it also hits on that idea of corporations acting as people and considered people by governments. I mean, you know, a corporation is a person, yet it's not a person when it acts in a...
You know, I wonder about that, though, because they're considered people when it's campaign contributions.
Right.
I don't know, like outside of campaign contributions, are they still considered people or are they considered corporations?
Well, that's the thing. They want to be considered people when it's beneficial to them, right?
That's right, right. So that's a very interesting comment. I don't know if the foreign policy theater has identified that, whether that recognition of if corporations as an individual extends into the foreign policy arena.
Well, it just goes to show that a company really acts without morals. There's the argument that, you know, if a company really were a person, then you'd have to hold them to the same moral standard that you hold people to, right? And again, like we see here, like we saw here with IBM, and again with Siemens, they're acting completely with a monetary goal and void of morals. And so it's hard to make the argument that these are people, these companies.
Yeah, in fact, I think this is another incident of profits over people.
We want to take a quick break to remind you that you are listening to Eye on the Middle East. I'm your host, Benjamin Gottlieb.
And I am your co-host, Arzu Rezvani. Consul General David Siegel will be joining us in our next segment to discuss escalating tensions between Israel and Iran. Mr. Siegel, it's a real pleasure to have you on our program today.
Thank you for having me. It's great to be with you.
So my first question is, over the course of the last decade, Israel has refrained from launching what some think would be a risky military strike against Iran, choosing instead to deter Iran from its ability to produce nuclear weapons. Why are the Israelis choosing to abandon a policy of deterrence now versus, say, you know, a couple of years ago?
We've known about the Iranian nuclear program for just about probably over 15 years now. And our approach has always been to try to deal with this, first of all, as an international issue that it is, not just an Israel-based issue, because, you know, Iran does threaten the region, not just Israel, but many countries in the region and also in the international realm. So our approach has always been to bring, you know, the international community together around an effort to try to convince Iran not to develop nuclear weapons, because it would be very bad for the region for many, many reasons that should be pretty obvious now. And this effort is still ongoing. It's something that we still very much believe in. We think it really is about the world coming together and sending Iran a message that this is not acceptable. It would be a very, very dangerous thing. The Middle East is going through a very significant period of transition. It's almost been a year now for this Arab Spring, and it's a region of vast need. So over 300 million people facing very, very difficult social, economic, societal issues, and you don't want to see regimes collapse with nuclear weapons in the region. You know, we were very close to that in Libya, in other countries, and we don't want this nuclear race in the Middle East, and we certainly don't want a more aggressive Iran doing it with nuclear weapons. So it's a big issue. It's a global issue, and I think it's still worth making the added effort, because the hour is very, very late on this, to try to impress upon Iran the severity of what's going on.
Sure, and there were reports last week that Iran was planning to step away from the IAEA to get rid of international investigators. I mean, do you think that marks a significant point in Israeli action or an Israeli response to Iran?
Well, I haven't seen that actually happen. There have been some reports about that, but that would be a very, very significant move on the part of Iran, and that would really mean that it was the end for, you know, the diplomatic effort to resolve this issue. And if they do that, it would be very, very significant. I don't see evidence of that happening at this point. We still see the IAEA able to function, although in a limited way, inside Iran. And it's very, very important, because that is basically the agency that brings the world the information about the status of Iran's nuclear program. And the latest report is very disconcerting, because it does show in very clear and stark terms information that we've known for several years, and other major governments in the West have known, but now it's known publicly that they are working on a nuclear weapon system, and this is something that is very, very significant.
Now, you talked about the threat that a nuclear Iran would pose to that region. Is a nuclear Iran more dangerous than a nuclear Pakistan?
Well, I mean, nuclear countries that are not stable is very dangerous, would be very dangerous by definition. But Iran is sort of unique on several levels that I'll try to lay out. Look, they're very active across the Middle East in fomenting terrorism and extremist groups, not just vis-a-vis Israel, but throughout the region. So if I just look at Lebanon, for example, it's a country that was once, independent. It's now more and more controlled by Iran and its proxy Hezbollah, which is a terror organization that is now part of the government of Lebanon. Now, Iran has transferred to Hezbollah 50,000 rockets and missiles. It's a vast amount of armaments. They're now, collected in civilian villages, inside people's homes, under hospitals and schools, and they're basically facing Israel. And at some point, when they release these rockets and missiles, it's going to be a disaster for the region because we'll have to respond. And you can just imagine, what this will entail just in terms of human lives and the tragedy that is almost foretold because, you see these armaments growing and growing. Now, Iran transferred all this to a terror group in Lebanon, 50,000 missiles and rockets. World War II, when Germany fired rockets on London that we all know about and we've learned about, that was just several hundred rockets and missiles. I don't think there's a situation, at least in modern history, where a country's facing 50,000 missiles in the hand of a terror group. That's just in the north. In the south, they've done it with Hamas in Gaza, 10 to 20,000 rockets and missiles, and they're firing these every several weeks at Israel now, and that's very, very dangerous as well. But they're not just active in our part of the world. They're in Latin America, in Central America, in Mexico. The U.S. federal government just put out indictments about Iranian agents in Washington, D.C. that sought to kill the Saudi ambassador and blow up the Israeli embassy, so that they're active here. We know that they're connected to the Mexican drug cartel, and they come in and out, so that they're involved in this part of the world as well. So they have, long-range missile programs that cover the Middle East, that cover Europe. We know that they're working on missiles that will reach the United States, and they're doing all of this without nuclear weapons. When they have nuclear weapons, they'll be even that much more dangerous, and they'll provoke other programs in the region. And again, a Middle East that is going through all of this crisis and transition, to think about, nuclear stockpiles in the hands of regimes that are collapsing in the face of resistance from their own streets, is just something that the world can't afford to see unfolding.
Right. Now, David, you're kind of describing, from what I'm interpreting it, as a doomsday scenario. I mean, there are a lot of threats that are facing the West, that are facing the developed world. I mean, what's the next step? I mean, if this is all true, if Iran is literally operating satellites across the globe, I mean, what is the next step?
Well, again, our approach is, look, there are three storms in the world right now. There's certainly, there's a problem with terrorism, which is ongoing. There's a problem throughout the Middle East, which is very, very significant, and as we said, will be with us for many, many years to come, and will challenge the societies of the Middle East and the world. And there's the global economic challenge, and all of these storms are happening at the same time. So I think the key is to be as constructive, pragmatic, and wise as we can be. And it doesn't mean that there aren't challenges and threats out there, but it does mean that we need to work together, the responsible countries of the world, to find ways to peacefully diffuse a lot of these crises. So it's being done economically in all theaters, all sorts of areas, focus on Europe right now. In the Middle East, there needs to be a vision for the region so that peoples can, begin to heal and work on their societal, economic issues that they need to work on. And vis-a-vis Iran, there needs to be a real effort on the part of Russia, China, Europe, America, to, if it needs to be economic sanctions, and they need to be very, very tough, to send Iran a message that they can't continue doing what they're doing. And we still hope that that it would be possible to do this through diplomatic means. But we also need to make very, very clear that it is a doomsday scenario, and that it is unacceptable. And if it continues, then there needs to be a military or all options on the table kind of message that is credible, and that they understand that the world won't let them do this, because it is a very destabilizing phase that we would enter if this would actually happen.
Now, are Israeli officials at all concerned that this is a scenario that's very comparable, that may be very comparable to the Iraq War The reason why I ask this is a couple of weeks ago, I came across an old New York Times article dated from 1995, authored by Chris Hedges. And in that article, a number of Israeli and U.S. officials said that Iran would be able to build an atomic bomb in 5 years. And again, that was in 1995. Now, it's 16 years later, and as far as we know, there's still no nuclear bomb. What do you say to those people out there who just don't buy these estimates and are hesitant to share the concerns of Israeli officials today?
Well, it's a very good question. And part of the reason why we haven't seen a bomb yet is because there's been a huge effort to try to delay it and block it. So when you impose economic restrictions on Iran, you're also imposing restrictions on their ability to develop a bomb so that they can't import the systems that they need. You're banning scientists from coming and going. So there's been a huge effort to slow down the Iranian program, and that has been partially successful.
And do we know that the Chinese and the Russians have not been filling that void and providing them with the know-how and the tools to make those nuclear arms?
Well, different countries have done different things, but the bottom line is now that when you bring a resolution against Iran to the Security Council or to the UN bodies, you have countries that are more excited about it and others that are trying to block it. And it's certainly true that Russia and China need to do more to convey to Iran, again, the message that the world is serious, because the Iranians don't think that the world is united on this issue.
Right.
So it would be very, very important to get the main stakeholders of sort of the world security system together to send them a united message that this can't continue this way.
Now, David, the Federation of American Scientists came out with a report in 2010 that there are 9 nuclear nations. It also estimated that Israel has about 80 nuclear weapons. And I'm thinking to the 6-party talks of disarmament between the U.S. and China in trying to negotiate with North Korea to get rid of their nuclear stockpile. Is it possible that some sort of talks could be beneficial to the situation with Iran? And also, do you think that some disarmament of Israel, for example, could be beneficial, just looking from an Iranian perspective?
Well, you know, first of all, for many, many years, our approach has been that that the Middle East should be free of nuclear weapons, but that needs to be part of overall process of regional, of stabilizing the region, of reaching peace with the main countries in the region, and dealing with all the problems that have to do with weaponry. Now, you know, the issue you raised, North Korea. North Korea is basically a country that developed nuclear weapons for bargaining, for economic prospects,
right,
for aid. Iran is in a very different place. If you ask the Saudis and the Gulf countries or the Sunni countries of the region what the main threat to their regimes are or to their well-being is, it's Iran.
But Iran is also doing very poorly economically.
Iran is, well, the evidence is mixed. I mean, the economic sanctions have certainly taken a bite on the Iranian economy, and Iran is facing many, many hurdles in doing business overseas because of the decisions that they took on the nuclear plane. But it's still not enough to get them to take a decision to slow down or to stop the nuclear program.
But so you think these kind of talks, direct talks with Iran, sitting down at the table, would not be successful or fruitful?
Well, we've tried it. We've tried it for many, many years now, and there's still an attempt to keep that going, and sometimes you need leverage when you enter these kind of talks. But the evidence is that all these years, the Iranians, despite the negotiations, use those negotiations to gain time and continue developing the program.
David, thanks so much for your time. We appreciate it.
Sure.
This is Eye on the Middle East, broadcast live from the USC Annenberg Graduate School of Journalism.
Please be sure to subscribe to our podcast on iTunes. Just search for Neon Tommy, Eye on the Middle East. Thank you, and stay tuned for next week's podcast. Take care.